Good morning. Thanks for coming. I'm actually at University of Missouri at Kansas City. It's confusing, the Kansas versus Kansas City, Missouri issue. But as Steve said, I was lucky to participate in a really wonderful initiative when I was at Oregon Health and Science University as a postdoctoral fellow. My colleagues at OHSU convened an expert panel on health promotion programs for people with disabilities, and they undertook a couple of initiatives. One was developing guidelines for the implementation of health promotion programs for people with disabilities, and another was conducting a systematic scoping review of the literature on health promotion programs for people with disabilities. And the purpose of the study today is to compare those two initiatives, so to compare the guidelines that we developed or the ideal with what we found in the literature as a result of our review or the reality. I have no relationships to disclose. So, as many of you know, people with disabilities comprise an important and sizable population in the United States. Depending on how disability is measured, up to 50 million Americans report having disabilities. An important belief of our expert panel is that disability does not equal ill health. So people with disabilities can be healthy and have the right to pursue health. In the last 10 years, there has been a significant increase in health promotion programs for people with disabilities, which is a really wonderful phenomenon, but we wanted to look at what do these health promotion programs look like. At the time that this study was started, there were no national standards specific to disability, so that was another goal of this initiative. So we developed guidelines for health promotion in three areas. There are many health promotion guidelines for the general population, and we developed operational guidelines, which are similar to some of these general guidelines, but in a more condensed form. They represent things that you might see, for example, in the RE-AIM guidelines. But they also looked at what is the role of people with their disabilities and families in health promotion program development and implementation, and how do programs ensure that they are accessible for people with disabilities as well. Since I'm talking about two studies today, both of which are pretty methods heavy, I'm not really going to be able to give you much depth about the methods, but please feel free to ask me more questions if you have questions about these. But in brief, the guidelines development, the expert panel was formed, the charge was presented to the expert panel, and then they met frequently in an iterative process through monthly teleconferences and in-person meetings where they had facilitated discussion. This facilitated discussion process really had roots in the nominal group consensus process, and an effort was made throughout the guideline development to reach consensus on the panel. And then their work was also informed by literature reviews. The work of the expert panel combined empirical, practical, and philosophical components. The expert panel is listed here. There are a few of us that were postdocs or staff that were very fortunate to be listed on this list. Me, Rie Suzuki, Carla Cully, and Tori Kimpton. But the experts that were recruited because of their longtime expertise are Gloria Cron, Charles Drum, Tom Seekins, Tamar Heller, Glenn White, Jeff McCubbin, and Jim Rimmer. And they're from Oregon Health and Science University, Oregon State University, the University of Illinois at Chicago, the University of Kansas, and the University of Montana. The guidelines focused on community-based health promotion programs rather than rehabilitation programs really was the distinction there. And health promotion programs in general were programs to improve overall health or well-being or reduce secondary conditions among people with disabilities. These guidelines were aimed at people across disability types, including physical, sensory, or cognitive disabilities. People with mental health disabilities were not included in this particular effort, partly because of the scope of the project and also because of the expertise of people on the expert panel. And the target of the guidelines really was quite broad. It was community-based programs, but the panel hoped to have the guidelines be relevant to implementers in the community, but also researchers in the field as well. So I'm just going to briefly go over the seven guidelines and their focus. First, health promotion programs for people with disabilities should have an underlying conceptual or theoretical framework. This includes theoretical framework from health behavior theory or health promotion theory, but the expert panel also emphasized the importance of looking to other theories and concepts that are specific to people with disabilities or other fields, disability studies, education, etc. Health promotion programs should implement process evaluation, and health promotion programs should use disability-appropriate outcome measures. So they were looking both at evaluating the process, getting feedback from people with disabilities as they were designing and implementing interventions, but also measuring outcomes first and foremost, and that those outcomes be disability-appropriate. So I'll talk about that a little bit more when we're talking about what we actually found with the review, but measures of health penalize people's health if they have functional limitations, and that was another thing that the expert panel emphasized as problematic. There's two participation criteria. One is that people with disabilities, families, or caregivers should be involved in the development and implementation of health promotion programs. And the second is that health promotion programs should consider the beliefs, practices, and values of people with disabilities, including support for personal choice. These participation guidelines reflect best practices in health promotion practice, but also emphasize these issues for people with disabilities because philosophically, the independent living and disability civil rights movement have been so important in the lives of people with disabilities. And then I'll move on to accessibility criteria. First, health promotion programs should be socially and behaviorally accessible, and health promotion programs should be physically and programmatically accessible. So they were looking at the physical aspects of accessibility, but also that people were respected, et cetera. And finally, health promotion programs should be affordable to people with disabilities, families, and caregivers. Unfortunately, there's a large overlap between individuals of low socioeconomic status and people with disabilities, so affordability was an important component as well. The expert panel also oversaw a systematic scoping review effort. A systematic scoping review, basically, it uses systematic review methods, but it's larger in scope. We often say that it's to map the literature landscape. So where a traditional systematic review will often look at one outcome variable and compare the effectiveness of studies in reaching that outcome or how they affect that outcome variable, this had many different outcome variables, and we are really looking at what exists in the published literature as far as health promotion for people with disabilities and where are the gaps. Our search strategy resulted in almost 4,000 abstracts that were reviewed, and after abstract and full text review, 79 studies were included. And there are a broad range as far as topic, and then some, so for example, they had physical activity, stress reduction, sexual health, and then also studies that focused on multiple topics or health and wellness in general. So now I'm going to compare the results of the guidelines and what we found in our scoping review. There are a large number of gaps. Theoretical framework, 11 of the 79 studies reported a theoretical framework. The most commonly named theory was the social cognitive theory, which 4 studies named that theory. As far as disability appropriate outcome measures, there was a huge number of outcome measures used across studies. As you can imagine, given that there was a very wide number of topics included, 221 different outcome measures used, 93 different physiological measures, and 128 non-physiological measures. This isn't necessarily problematic as far as matching with the guidelines. It's a little more problematic when we're trying to compare effectiveness as researchers, but this large variety did include a number of studies that had very disability appropriate measures. There were measures that were developed specifically for people with disabilities. But there were also some areas where there definitely could be improvement. One area that of note, for example, is the SF-36 is used in 15 studies, and one of the components of health in the SF-36 is physical functioning, which isn't appropriate for all people with disabilities. Because, for example, if you can't climb a flight of stairs, you'll have a less good of a health score, and that's not necessarily going to be appropriate for looking at the effectiveness of health promotion programs then for people with those disabilities. As far as participatory components by people with disabilities, 5 studies were coded as having participation in program development by people with disabilities, 3 of the 79 studies identification of outcomes, 3 review prior to implementation, 1 that people with disabilities reviewed the program outcomes, and 6 that people with disabilities were involved in implementation. Again, these are all out of 79 as the denominator. And as far as accessibility components, this part we were actually kind of surprised that more people didn't describe the accessibility of their studies. 3 described accessible transportation, 4 environmental accessibility features, 4 that their program materials were accessible, and 1 that outcome measures were available in alternate formats for people. However, 17 studies did say that accommodations were provided upon request. And affordability, we couldn't look at affordability that directly because often what's reported in studies is cost of implementing the programs or cost effectiveness. But there are very few studies that report anything about cost. 3 reported cost, 2 cost effectiveness. So in conclusion, there was a significant disconnect between guidelines and the scoping review. There's a couple of things, though, that I want to make sure that I point out. One is that there are limitations by journals and what authors decide to include when they're limited on the number of words, and we don't know that these studies didn't do these things, they just didn't report them. However, our expert panel would assert that for translation to the field of research to practice, reporting these things and having especially the accessibility components and involvement of people with disabilities in your studies, reporting that in your literature is very important. Also, the community-based, the guidelines were developed with community-based interventions in mind, and what we're comparing it to is the research literature. So we also would love to continue to compare, you know, what's actually happening in practice. So that's one limitation, is that these guidelines were developed for community-based programs, really, and what we were able to look at in this study was comparing to things published in the literature. I actually have contact information for the PI of this study, Dr. Charles Drum here, but I have cards as well, so if anyone would like to talk to me about anything I presented in this presentation, see me afterwards. Thanks very much.